Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 116, recorded on Thursday, October 13th, 2011. A molecular thermometer. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki. This is episode 116, and I hope you are ready. Just like always, we have 1 hour on one topic. Well, maybe it might go through a few different topics related, though, with one expert. And it's time to dig in and get dirty in the science of telling Mars's temperature. And we're going to be speaking today with Dr. John Eiler from the California Institute of Technology. But before we get into the big conversation for the hour, a few science headlines. In a step toward eradicating the pools of HIV that hide behind the blood-brain barrier and enable HIV to escape the body's immune system, researchers report the successful creation of a potential new drug. The drug works in two stages. First, it halts the mechanism that normally keeps antiviral medications from crossing the blood-brain barrier, and then it crosses the barrier itself to destroy HIV. Sounds like a pretty good drug, and I'll be watching to see what happens with it. Do you eat a balanced diet? Well, according to a recent study, you probably don't need to take a multivitamin, but you should probably take that calcium supplement. Just a thought. Publishing in the journal Science this week, researchers say they have corrected sickle cell anemia in mice. To do so, they blocked a protein that's called BCL11A from being produced. This then caused a reversion of hemoglobin from the sickle-shaped adult form to the normal-shaped fetal form. According to Bavarian paleontologists, the most complete dinosaur fossil ever has been unearthed. It is approximately 98% complete with bits of skin attached, and it's assumed to be a year-old theropod dinosaur. The complete genome of the Black Death bacterium has been published. The genetic material for the genome was gathered from the teeth of its victims. And where should we put our solar panels? A new analysis of potential for photovoltaic power generation by a Japanese research team suggests that some high-altitude places like the Himalayan mountains might be even more suitable to solar energy prospects than deserts based on how much sunlight they receive and their relatively low temperatures, which would allow the panels to work more efficiently. Astronomers found the first evidence of black holes ripping apart stars this past week, called tidal disruption flares, or TDFs. They are the radiation that is emitted from a galaxy as the material from the star tumultuously orbits around the black hole and is devoured by it. Their data suggests that this happens about once every 100,000 years per galaxy. And finally, never mind astrology, your future is all in the numbers. Statistical analysis of birth month and career type suggest high correlations for certain combinations. December babies are more likely to be dentists, while January babies tend to be debt collectors. That's the science news for this week. And now a word from our sponsor. I'd like to thank Netflix.com for sponsoring this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. There's an iPad app on your iPhone and some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. But if you're not a gamer and you have something like an Apple TV or a Roku box, they can let you watch the movies or TV shows as well. And with Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly with any of these devices, starting on one device, stopping, and then you can start where you left off on any of the other devices. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies or TV shows as you want, anytime you want. And you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days free. Just go to netflix.com/twit. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix, and be sure to use the URL to get your free trial. netflix.com/twit. So it's time to bring in our guest expert for the hour. Dr. John M. Eiler is the Robert P. Sharp Professor of Geology and Professor of Geochemistry at Caltech. He is interested in the isotope geochemistry of light elements, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and sulfur, as applied to the origin and evolution of igneous rocks, the origin and evolution of meteorites, planetary atmospheres, atmospheric and environmental chemistry, paleoclimate, and paleontology. He has published on topics seemingly unrelated as climate change, dinosaurs, the moon, and now Mars. This past week, there was a paper published which talks about the past temperature of Mars using a meteorite. I'd like to welcome Dr. Eiler to the show. John, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Kiki. It's a lot of fun to be able to come on and talk with you about my research.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to digging into this as deeply as we can. So the first question off the top, geochemistry, what got you interested in the rocks of our planet and possibly other rocky planets elsewhere in the universe?
Oh, I had an unusual path to this discipline compared to most of my colleagues. I actually went to college to be an anthropologist. I thought I would be a sort of Indiana Jones kind of character. And it turned out I spent most of my time in a museum basement painting numbers on little chips of rock. But I was hired as a porter by the geology department. I took an introductory geology course, and the instructor realized that I knew enough about canoeing and cooking and fishing and things like that. But they hired me as a porter, and I saw what they were doing and thought, this is a lot better than sitting in a basement. So that's how I got into geology. And how I wandered into geochemistry, it's a sort of convoluted tale. I'm not really trained as a chemist in any formal sense, but it's a tool that was used in the laboratory where I got my PhD. And I took that tool and adapted it and just sort of, you know, it's a seed that I let grow.
I think that's always a really interesting aspect of how scientists kind of get to the specialization where they are, is the path that they take. Very often in your PhD studies, you'll learn one technique and then maybe move to a different lab during your postdoc for another technique and learn different things that you can bring together to bear on science in your own particular way.
Yeah, I think it's important for scientists to not only pick a field that they focus on and develop some sort of expertise in, but let yourself be an individual, who you are. You know, all of the really great scientists who I admire, they're all idiosyncratic, distinctive people, and they're not afraid just to let their personality and their personal interests and their life impact their work. So I think it's important to let that happen.
All right. So you had your interesting path getting to where you are. What exactly are you focusing on? I mean, in the introduction, your research interests that I got from your website bio, you know, it's a broad spectrum. You're looking at geology. You're looking at it from rocks, meteorites, atmosphere, paleoclimate. I mean, it seems really broad. What is it that ties everything together?
This is an outgrowth of a very simple decision that I made about 8 years ago. I was at a turning point in my career. I had just received tenure and was looking forward into the main part of my career, asking myself what it would be about now that I had a position in a laboratory. And I decided to focus on a very fundamental question about the distribution of isotopes in nature that I knew hadn't been extensively explored. It would be something that had a lot of discoveries available in it, but also a lot of uncertainty. It wasn't clear what it was for or how it could be pursued. But I just made a simple decision to go after it as a thing to explore. And from that grew many different kinds of applications mm-hmm. to reconstructing past environments, to understanding the budgets of natural compounds like atmospheric CO2. And now with more recent innovations in the same line of research, my students and postdocs and colleagues and I are starting to talk about applications to medicine, to diagnosis. This is one of those subjects where if you start scratching at some new, previously uncovered part of the chemistry of natural materials, you may find yourself wandering in almost any direction or many directions at once.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So let's dig into this. How do the methods that you use in your lab work? Like what's the basis for what you're doing?
The core of what we're doing is to study the distribution in nature of naturally occurring stable isotopes. So let's break that down. The word isotope means same place. And it refers to the same place on the periodic table. It refers to two or more generally similar atomic species, nuclear species, that share the same number of protons. Because of that, the neutrally charged version of the nuclide, the atom, has the same electronic structure and therefore very similar chemistry. But these two or more versions of that atom have different mass. They differ in their number of neutrons. And this difference in mass, it can lead to all kinds of changes in the behavior of the atom. For very heavy atoms or atoms that have very unusual numbers of neutrons in them, they can actually become unstable and the nucleus will decay. And so this is the source of radioactivity. But there are also isotopes that we refer to as stable isotopes where they have an unusual number of neutrons, but it's okay. It doesn't lead to nuclear instability, and these species can persist as long-lived, basically permanent parts of the environment that are just unusual versions of the chemical species we're accustomed to working with. So because these things differ in mass from the usual versions, like, for example, carbon normally has a mass of 12 atomic units, but sometimes there are some versions of it that have 13, and sometimes there are versions that have a mass of 14. The version that has a mass of 14 is unstable, and that's the source of radioactivity, and it's a means of dating things. The one that has a mass of 13, it's about 1% of naturally occurring carbon, but it's perfectly stable, and it is widely distributed in nature. So we're studying the distribution of these things. This is a discipline that has existed for about 70 years, and it was an outgrowth of the discoveries in nuclear chemistry in the first half of the 20th century. It's a discipline that grew enormously immediately after World War II because there was a large cadre of young scientists who were trained in the nuclear sciences as part of the Manhattan Project. And then they went off into many different disciplines, medicine, physics, engineering. Some of them went into earth science and used the distribution of isotopes as a tool. For essentially all of the history of this discipline, the question we have asked analytically, when we pick up a natural object and measure its naturally occurring isotopes, is a very simple question. We just want to count all of the rare isotopes in this object and report back to you a concentration. There is such and such a percentage of carbon-13 in this leaf, or there's so and so much deuterium, a rare isotope of hydrogen, in this sample of natural gas. What I started working on a number of years ago is to ask a slightly different version of this question, to ask not just how many of these rare isotopes are present in a natural material, but where are they in the molecular structure, in the biological structure of something big and complex like a protein, in the mineral structure of something solid like calcite, the mineral calcite? Where specifically are these isotopes at the atomic scale? And how often, one version of that question is, how often do two rare isotopes seek each other out and form a bond with each other? And so I'm basically asking questions about the spatial organization of isotopes rather than just their concentration.
Right. So in looking at how they're organized, do you find what kind of patterns do you find that seem to recur? Are there certain things that indicate particular conditions, certain levels of carbon-13 and carbon-14, whether they're even or mismatched, with one being higher or lower than the other?
So there are several different directions we can go with that, because it's the patterns of spatial distributions of isotopes in natural things, they reflect all kinds of different processes. Let's start with a kind of metaphor. If you were to take, say, genes from a living cell and analyze it in the crudest way you can think of, you just count up all of the different carbon atoms and nitrogen atoms and hydrogen atoms and phosphorus atoms and so forth, and report back the chemical composition of, say, DNA in that cell, that would tell you very little. You would know loosely what kind of chemical compound you were working with, but not much more. Genomics is based upon figuring out the spatial organization, the ordering of a gene. How do these elements pattern themselves to do useful work in recording information, and templating proteins, and so forth? And so we're asking a very similar question, and it leads to it releases a huge amount of information. So one of the simplest pieces of information that we get, and this lets us focus towards the reason that you asked me to be on the show, is there's a thermodynamic force, propensity, to make rare isotopes, most of which are heavy. They're heavier than their usual version.
So it would be the carbon 14 as opposed to carbon 13.
Let's focus on carbon 13 and carbon 12. So carbon 13 is the rare stable isotope. Carbon 12 is the common one.
Okay.
And let's say I have a mineral that contains only carbon, let's say a diamond. If I had that diamond in a perfectly random growth where it's randomly adding carbon 12 and carbon 13 atoms, I would end up with the most disordered version of it that I could think of. But that would not be the most thermodynamically stable version. That the bonds between two heavy isotopes, between, say, two adjacent carbon-13 atoms, they're relatively stable. And so, in a way, every chemical bond in nature wants to have heavy isotopes in it, but there aren't enough to go around. Mm-hmm. And so the minerals compete with each other for them in a thermodynamic sense. Minerals that grow from water compete with water for heavy isotopes. This sort of competition was well understood before the sort of work that my group is doing. But in addition, if you look inside a mineral, different sites in the mineral are competing with each other for those rare isotopes, which are desirable. And the most desirable outcome for the mineral as a whole is that the two heavy isotopes find each other and form a chemical bond. And so there's this driving force to sort of clump together rare heavy isotopes in solids. It's also true in gas molecules, organic molecules. So this can lead to a kind of thermometry, because the propensity to form these clumps where rare isotopes seek each other out and form bonds together, this scales with temperature. At very low temperatures, the energetic benefit of forming a heavy isotope bond wins. As you raise temperature, all natural chemical systems, they have a sort of preference to become more random, okay, to have a greater, we call it greater entropy. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why solids will melt when you heat them, because a liquid has a more random structure, more degrees of freedom in it than a solid. Mm-hmm. And similarly, if I take a solid that has all of its rare isotopes clumped together, sticking to each other, and I heat it up, it will, its energetic bargain will be the warmer I get, the more random I want to be. The colder I am, the more clumpy I want to be. And there's mm-hmm. a sort of sliding scale between those two extremes. And so what we've done is to figure out ways to reconstruct, to analyze where a mineral sits on that scale in its degree of ordering or clumping. And in materials that grow at thermodynamic equilibrium, this is a thermometer. In other materials, it has other kind of information. But in minerals that grow at equilibrium, you get to learn the temperature that they grew at.
Huh. That's fascinating. So it's basically by inference, inferring the clumpiness of the material based on those isotopes, the heavy isotopes clumping together or being randomly ordered.
Is we have to measure them directly. We yeah. have to get the bonds out of the mineral without breaking them and work them through some sort of analytical device like a mass spectrometer mm-hmm. and collect them, count them, without ever breaking the bond between the atoms. Because if we break the bond in the course of our measurement, now we just have
random collection.
Yeah, exactly. A random collection of isotopes. And that's the information we've had for decades.
Right.
And so all of our analytical techniques, they're geared around creating species that can be counted some way. Usually analytical chemists, we like to turn something into a charged particle, an ion, and then separate it by some electronic property, like passing it through an electrostatic field or passing it through a magnet, mm-hmm. and then collect it electronically, measure the current that it delivers to some circuit. And so we have to do this without breaking the chemical bonds. We have to do it on molecules. And so this is where the technical challenges come in.
Has the technology, you said that this is something that's been worked on for about 70 years. Has the technology changed significantly over that time?
Yeah. So when I first thought about doing this about 8 years ago, I looked around my laboratory and I saw a bunch of instruments that they're nicely painted. They look like they came from IKEA. Okay. They're very well, they have nice aesthetic engineering. But basically, physically, they were like machines that were built 60 or 70 years ago in people's basements. They're not sophisticated machines. They're very mm-hmm. simple mass spectrometers. And so there was a whole set of modifications that I wanted to make on these machines in order to pursue this line of research that I've described to you. And I came up with a long laundry list of things I wanted to have done and went to companies, commercial firms that will build mass spectrometers for you, and described to them what I was after. And they all laughed and said, "This is ridiculous. It's going to be very expensive. There's no particular reason to do it. There's no science behind this. We're not going to sell a bunch of these things. Go away." And so I said, "Well, I'll go away because you told me to, but I'm going to come back." And I came back with a much shorter list, a very tractable list of things that could be done. Little teeny tweaks, things that could have been done 50 years ago.
Right.
Just nobody really thought to do it, or they didn't, or if they thought of it, they didn't think it was worth it, or for whatever reason, they didn't do it. Little teeny changes in the positioning of collectors, in the sensitivity of the collectors, and just in the usage, how we measured a gas, the way that we would go about it, we had to modify somewhat. But these are all very subtle changes, and in a way, it was important that I had to do that because we were only able to do one or two types of measurements. So all of the science that has come from this field has been done on these sort of limited instruments, and a significant amount has come from it. And then the discipline has spread quickly to many other institutions because it's so easy to adapt to. You can take commercial machines and just barely tweak them, less than you would do to soup up your car, and you can make it make this measurement. So then about a year ago, 2 years ago, I went back to these mass spectrometer manufacturers and I said, okay, remember what I said to you all those years ago? Now I mean it. Let's really do this. And they just sold 30 or 40 of these machines. And so they're now interested. And we have just constructed, in fact, will be delivered to my laboratory in a few weeks. We've just constructed the real version of the mass spectrometer that's needed for this approach.
Wow.
And what it will open up is the ability to very finely separate isotopic versions of molecules that so far we've not been able to separate. So in particular, one of the problems you have, it's intrinsic to the technique. We wish to analyze the isotopic content of molecules. Molecules have multiple atomic sites in them.
Right.
But that means there can be more than one way that a molecule gets to a certain mass. For example, one way that this carbon dioxide molecule can get to a mass, usually has a mass of 44, 12 for carbon, 16 for oxygen, 16 for another oxygen. It can get to a mass of 45 by having a carbon 13 atom. It could also get to a mass of 45 by having an oxygen 17 atom. We can't tell the difference, okay?
And you just know that it's heavier or lighter.
It's heavier. And so far, we've been working around this problem with sort of kludges and funny inferences, and there are various technical ways to try and do an end run around this. But the most interesting problems concern the isotopic distribution in organic molecules. And I don't say most interesting out of a narrow judgment about what kind of scientific problems are most interesting to me, like meteorites or whatever. It's just the biggest unknown field and the most opportunity. And the reason is that the chemistry of organic matter is incredibly diverse. There are millions of organic compounds as opposed to only thousands of minerals. And they're all made of a small number of atoms, carbon, hydrogen, little nitrogen, okay? Mm-hmm. And in many, many different spatial organizations, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the combinatorial properties of these things, when you start thinking about how many isotopic versions of them there are, is gargantuan. It's enormously larger than the playing field of any other type of isotope chemistry I can easily think of. And the chemistry of organic matter is connected not just to things like Earth history or the history of Mars or the origin of meteorites or things that I'm familiar working with. It's tied to life, medicine, ecosystems. It's tied to many different problems. And so it feels like a great opportunity. And the machine that we've built was particularly designed to let us ask these questions about isotopic organization in organic compounds, where the problem you have to solve is to separate a rare isotope of hydrogen, deuterium, from a rare isotope of carbon, carbon 13. You add one or the other, and the mass goes up by one, but not exactly one. They differ very slightly in their contribution to the mass. So the instrument we've built can tell that difference. It can separate a deuterium addition from a C13 addition. And this is sufficient for us to then take a molecule and really pick it apart and figure out all of the different species that contribute to its mass spectrum.
It just opens up so many different possibilities. You're going to have more machine time than you can handle. all the different studies that you could possibly do.
We're already, so the first one of these things is not even on our loading dock, and everybody in my group we're all sitting around going, how do we get another one? We're going to need another one, because we're going to be working around the clock on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you've done so far, what we brought you here today for specifically is the finding of temperature of Mars. Mm-hmm. And not the current temperature of Mars, but the temperature of Mars during a past period of its history. Can you tell us a little bit about like what went into your determination and what its implications are?
Yeah, so reconstructing climate on Mars is one of the great problems in the natural sciences. And it's something people have cared about as long as they've been able to see a little bit of detail on the surface of Mars with telescopes. Most recently, we've come to realize that the topography of Mars, the shape of the surface formations, make it obvious that there have been periods in the past when liquid water was an agent of erosion and deposition. That basically there were systems, river systems, lakes. They may not have been identical to the way the river and lake systems on the Earth operate, but they existed on Mars in the distant past. And today, this is completely impossible. There may be liquid water in the near subsurface of Mars, and it's possible that it leaks out here and there in little ephemeral springs, but there are no Martian rivers and there are no Martian lakes.
Right.
And so it's obvious that the climate of Mars was different in the past. In order for it to have been different, something about the radiative budget of the surface, that is, its pressure and proportions of greenhouse gases, maybe other properties as well, like its albedo, must have been different. And we'd like to have more coherent thoughts about that. We'd like to have models that describe how its climate was in the past. At the moment, these are models that are just framed around the idea that sometime in the distant past, we were in the stability field of liquid water. That's better than not knowing anything, but it's not a very precise target for your model to shoot for.
Right.
And so what we wanted to do was reconstruct a quantitative temperature, so and so many degrees, plus or minus so and so many degrees, at a specific time and place on Mars. On the Earth, that's a difficult but tractable undertaking because it's difficult because the geochemical methods involved are complex. And the materials are old and hard to interpret, but the geological record exists. You can find materials of widespread age. You can bring lots of them back in the laboratory to work on. On Mars, there's basically one rock from this era that we know of that we know formed and experienced a near-surface history of weathering and alteration early enough in Mars history that it's relevant for this question. And then just by stupid luck, it got bounced off the surface in an asteroid impact, meteorite impact on Mars, and it flew through space. And instead of being ejected from the solar system or landing in the sun or something, for some stupid reason, it landed on Earth. And then somebody found it. It's just like, sounds totally ridiculous that this could ever happen. In fact, before the Martian meteorites were found, it had been declared to be physically impossible. That this could occur. Now we have 50 of these things in our collections, but only one of them is really very old. And luckily, maybe it's not just luck, but it is fortuitous that one has a significant concentration of carbonate minerals. And carbonate minerals are a natural consequence of weathering chemistry that occurs at the Earth's surface. We've always thought it must be a consequence of the same kind of chemistry at the surface of Mars, but until very recently, we haven't really had evidence for the abundance and distribution of carbonate on Mars. In any event, what's interesting about the carbonate minerals is that they form in aqueous solutions at very near thermodynamic equilibrium. And it's just a simple, it wouldn't be true of many other salt minerals, like sulfate salt minerals, the mineral gypsum, for example. The sulfate ion group, it doesn't really exchange its isotopes with water very well. Carbonate is different. It exchanges its isotopes with water very well. And so the carbonate ion in solution is generally in equilibrium. And therefore, these principles I described to you a moment ago regarding the thermodynamically controlled clumping of isotopes, they apply to carbonate. And when the carbonate then precipitates as a mineral, filling cracks or voids in a weathering rock, it locks in this information about its temperature of formation.
And here on Earth, the carbonate material is also used. It's incorporated into the shells of living organisms, hard coral, many different species of organisms actually rely on carbonate.
That's right. And even though the biominerals in your body, your teeth and your bones are mostly phosphate, that phosphate contains a significant amount of carbonate that substitutes for the phosphate ions. And so it's a very widely distributed part of the aqueous chemistry of the surface, Earth's surface. And so there are lots of carbonate minerals. They're very widely distributed. And it's even a minor component of other minerals like apatite. Mm-hmm. So really the techniques that we applied to the Martian meteorite to obtain the temperature at which it underwent aqueous alteration, I was happy to apply them to the Mars problem, but they were developed to work on the Earth. They were developed to understand the climate history of the Earth's surface and the body temperatures of ancient terrestrial animals.
Right, and that's so this is the same methodology that you used to basically take the temperature of dinosaurs in a previous published study.
That's right. Earlier this summer, we published the first body temperatures of dinosaurs measured using this technique, where we took the enamel from the teeth of adult sauropods. And this is work done by Rob Eagle, who's a postdoctoral scholar in my laboratory. I should also comment that Itai Halevi is the postdoctoral scholar who did the Martian meteorite work. In any event, we recovered enamel from their teeth and dissolved that enamel in phosphoric acid and recovered the carbon dioxide that evolved that came from carbonate ion groups in the teeth. And that recorded the temperature of the animal's head, I suppose, at the time that their teeth grew.
And so would you think that the carbon came from dietary sources or from the air, just specifically from as they breathed it?
Yeah, so most big animals inhale something like 300 or 400 parts per million carbon dioxide and then exhale several percent. So you definitely do inhale atmospheric carbon dioxide, and it's some of it dissolves, exchanges with your body fluids. But this is overwhelmingly dominated by the carbon dioxide that's generated in your body from respiration. Mm. And so it would be dietary carbon that they respired. It becomes carbon dioxide. And then on its way to being exsolved from their blood and exhaled, it's as carbonate ion in the bloodstream and in other body fluids. And so the carbonate ion is then incorporated into growing teeth and bones, and once it's trapped, it can be modified by baking it, dissolving and reprecipitating the mineral. So there's all sorts of things that happen in the geological record that can trip us up. But if you find an intact sample, it will tell you the temperature at which it grew.
And that's the trick, finding the intact sample to be able to pull from. Yeah.
And this is where the arguments come as well. One of the interesting things about the earth sciences is that every object we study, every event in history is unique in some way, differs in some way from the history, the evolution of some other similar looking object. And so in this way, geology is different from, say, physics or chemistry, where you're most interested in what is common, what is the same between two experiments. In geology, you sort of want to know what is unique about every little experiment nature has run. And so we constantly will argue whether you got the right story. You know, is that piece of enamel the right one? Or how about this one over here? I like it better. This is where the interpretations get difficult. But we have, we did our best, and we have an answer that we presented.
Right, that's now open to the scientific community.
Right. That's right.
Exactly. So from the dinosaur work, you've brought up possible or probable body temperatures for the sauropods. The Martian meteorite, I love that the implication there is very much that as you said, the carbonate had to be laid down in an aqueous solution, which means in water. So it was probably in some body of water at some point in time.
Right. But there are many possibilities. So I could have liquid water on the Martian surface or in the shallow subsurface in a lot of different sorts of environments, like a hydrothermal vent, like Old Faithful, Yellowstone, or it could be an icy brine, like you might find underneath an Antarctic ice sheet somewhere, or anything in between. And so there are many different microenvironments that are compatible with the existence of water and the growth of carbonate. And what our measurement showed is that this particular carbonate grew at about 18 or 20 degrees centigrade. So a very moderate temperature. If you observe this temperature at the Earth's surface, you'd say, yeah, that's a sort of ordinary climatic temperature. That's not a hydrothermal process. It's not a cryogenic process, like melting of an ice cap or something. It's just like a normal atmospheric temperature. And so that makes it interesting. Then there are other unusual properties about the chemistry of these carbonate minerals. Very pronounced and distinctive zonation in their elemental composition and in their isotopic composition, which requires that during growth, they were growing from a solution that was undergoing a very extreme distillation during growth. And so we think that what was happening is this carbonate was growing from an evaporating pore fluid in cracks. And this implies that this was not like a lake or a standing aquifer in the subsurface that was just sort of always there like soil waters are in the earth, that this was an ephemeral water that was present and then evaporated away, and that's it. And so this is anyone who looks at our result and says, well, life likes water, life likes 18 degrees centigrade, therefore this supports the idea of life on Mars. And you can go that direction if you want, but hold on. Don't forget that this was an ephemeral event. It was something that was not a persistent condition. I wish we could say more. Unfortunately, this is how much you can learn from one rock that fell on your head out of the sky.
And it's an amazing amount.
It's an amazing amount, but it's frustrating. You can't go a lot further. You know, if you wish to say, yeah, but what about the day before that happened? What about 10 years later? What about 100 miles away? I don't know, man. I hope we know someday. This is what we know now.
Yeah. And you don't even know, you know, what part of the planet it's from.
That's correct.
It could have been any part in that sphere.
Yeah, we feel reasonably confident that it came from the shallow subsurface. And this is just a physical argument about the sorts of environments that are capable of launching fist-sized rocks into space without melting them or breaking them into dust. That it has to have been like a piece of shingle lying near the surface that got bounced off this planet. We don't really know whether it was at that depth at the time, you know, at every point in its history. That's difficult to say. There are many questions about it that it's frustrating, things we don't know. This is one of the reasons why there's such a drive for further robotic exploration of Mars and potentially returning samples from Mars. It's to help us nail down these sorts of problems.
Yeah, we're putting one of your special mass spectrometers on a robotic mission to Mars so that you can remotely do the analysis.
Yeah, that would be great. That's sort of George Jetson stuff, I'm afraid. At the moment, we're lucky if the one in the basement works. So that's like
Just bang on it a few times. Just smack it on the side. Yeah. Someone from the chat room is wondering, as far as technical challenges for working with something like a meteorite from Mars, how do you control for the passage of the meteorite through the atmosphere, its existence on the surface of our planet for however long it's been here, and the conditions that wouldn't those conditions affect what you're looking at?
That's a great question, and potentially it could. So the outer surfaces of meteorites have a fusion crust on them, and this is a shows you that the outer surface got so hot that it obviously melted. So it got to temperatures on the order of 1200, maybe 1400 centigrade. But that heating is very brief, and it doesn't penetrate deep inside the rock. So we know from measurements of the magnetic properties and the persistence of organic constituents in the interior of the rock that it never really got baked in the inside where we recovered samples, that was something that was restricted to the outer few millimeters of the rock. Regarding the weathering history on the surface, this is a major problem. Most of the carbonate that you find in old meteorites, there are two kinds of meteorites, falls, meaning it fell right next to you and you picked it up, or finds, you were wandering around and you just found it. This rock is a find. Who knows exactly what it has been through? We're helped here in that these carbonate minerals have been studied extensively, and we know that they have isotopic properties that are not observed in any terrestrial material and are common to Martian materials. And so that helps. Furthermore, you can measure carbon-14, which is produced in the Earth's atmosphere and trapped in young alteration minerals on the Earth's surface. And you see there's a little carbon-14 in the rock. It's an organic matter. But the carbonate minerals are not rich in carbon-14. So they're not recent weathering products. And you also know from the fabric of the carbonate that it actually existed prior to at least one or two episodes of brecciation and impact on the Martian surface. So these are, I'm pretty sure these are old components of this rock, but it's always an appropriate question. If we find another one that looks kind of like it tomorrow, you're back at ground zero. You got to ask all of these questions.
All over again. And there's with only something like 50 Martian meteorites on the planet, I'm sure there's always a little bit of trepidation when you go digging into the center of, or drilling into the center of the rock to try and take your samples.
Yeah, this particular one is so unusual and so precious, and the whole group of them are so rare and precious, that the biggest technical challenge to our study was that the postdoc working on this, Itai Halevi, he had to work for months and months to figure out how to make this specific sort of isotopic clumping measurement that's made in my lab, how to do it on a small amount of carbonate without, you know, the technique works better on bigger samples. And he didn't get quite as good as it is on the largest samples, but he pushed it and pushed it and pushed it until it was acceptable.
From other questions of applications of your work, you've also published on climate science, looking at the carbon isotopes here on our own planet. Can you tell us a little bit just about how your results came out and how it applies to climate science in general?
So one of the problems that we've been going after aggressively in the last 4 years also came to fruition in a paper this last year, is trying to reconstruct the climate history of the Earth in periods that sound very deep in Earth history, but they're not really. They're part of the geologically recent, in a way. There are periods of the Paleozoic that occurred maybe 300 to 400 million years ago, which sounds like a big number, so I warned you. But it's part of the Phanerozoic eon, the period when we think the Earth's surface broadly resembled the surface today. It varied in its climatic condition over ranges broadly like today. Macroscopic animals were alive for most of this period. There were plants on land. And so you're talking about an Earth that is not completely foreign to our current experience. But the Paleozoic, it had conditions that were very unusual. There were strange arrangements of the continents on the Earth's surface due to plate tectonic motions. We think that the mean state of the climate, the average climate, may have been quite a bit warmer for much of this period, and yet there were also protracted ice ages. And so understanding the dynamics of how climate worked on the Earth under these unusual conditions could help us understand the relationship between things that force climate, like atmospheric chemistry or albedo, and then the response of the climate system.
Right.
So it, This general interest is what motivated some of the very earliest studies in stable isotope geochemistry. And they attempted to reconstruct climate by comparing the isotopic composition of carbonate fossils to water. So the trouble is, and look, using thermodynamic isotopic fractionations that are broadly similar in principle to the ones we apply, but comparing two phases rather than thinking about the structure of a single phase. Mm-hmm. And the trouble with this was the geological record is full of fossil carbonate, but show me your fossil oceans. Okay, you don't know how to reconstruct the isotopic composition of the ocean. And so these studies had to adopt assumptions that basically predicated their results. And so we're trying to revisit these questions and directly measure the temperatures of formation of these Paleozoic ocean sediments. And the most recent thing that was done was to look at the variation of tropical climate through a very large ice age that happened during the Paleozoic. And it was associated with a large extinction. So several interesting things. So one of them, only a specialist would love. We think we figured out what the isotopic composition of the ocean actually was back then, and it was very similar to today. And so that sort of resolves one argument for the specialists. Another thing is we found that the mean state, the average state of tropical sea surface temperature, is pretty hot, sort of 35 or 34 degrees centigrade, which is, I forget exactly the conversion, something like 90 Fahrenheit, some of that order. Mm-hmm. So quite warm. It's not physically impossible. It's maybe not even that implausible, since the tropical ocean today is 30 degrees centigrade,
right,
in large pools. But it's quite a bit warmer than today. And our understanding of climate in the past should figure out how that relates to what people think about the atmospheric pressure, CO2 pressure back then.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing we found is that the ice age that occurred then, there we reconstructed the amount of ice that had been extracted from the oceans through time. And one thing that we found was interesting is that the tropics did not cool during an initial phase of growth of ice, meaning that the climate change that produced the glaciation was restricted to high latitudes. And then during the powerful pulse of glaciation when a mass extinction occurred, then the temperature drop reached all the way to the tropics and we saw it in our record. So we think that the mass extinction was not a response to just the fact that there were glaciers. It was that the glaciation somehow cooled off the tropics sharply and everybody died.
Right. There's probably a large number of species inhabiting the warm tropical region during that time, and a sudden glaciation and not being able to adapt quickly enough to be able to handle it.
Right. So there was sea level drop and cooling both.
Big factors to have to contend with.
Yeah, I would hate it if I was like swimming in the ocean eating krill and it got cold suddenly. That would be a big bummer for me. So I feel their pain.
Huge bummer. Yeah. This has been just a fascinating conversation. I'm really sorry that our hour has come to an end.
Yeah. We'll have to do it again sometime, huh?
I would love to. This has been just wonderful. Dr. John Eiler, thank you very much for joining me here today on the Science Hour. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. You're welcome. Bye. Everyone else out there, if you are interested in more information about molecular thermometers or dinosaurs, Martian meteorites, taking the temperature of so many things, be sure to visit Caltech's website for more information. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Our hour is done. And next week, we're going to be talking about the future of battery science. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Kiki. I'm Kiki Sanford on Google+, Dr. Kiki on Facebook. And you can subscribe to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour in iTunes, or you can just go find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. You can also find past episodes in video on YouTube in the Twit channel. If you need more sciencey goodness, You'll just have to follow me. Tell your friends to come on the sciencey goodness train. I will see you next week. Oh, yeah. You can email me, too. DrKiki@DrKiki.tv. I love your suggestions and your questions. Thanks for tuning in to my science hour. All I ask is 1 hour a week. And I do hope that 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. And now for our science meditation of the week. The video, if anyone is interested, is from the Dunbar Lab and is the video of a salamander extending its tongue under different temperature conditions. It seems that cold hinders the retraction of the salamander tongue.